Thank you very much, everyone, and good evening. Tonight, we have the motion before the House as this House has lost faith in faith, and we have an excellent lineup to be discussing it. Just a quick notice on how you can get involved with the debate as well. Firstly, during each of our speakers' speeches, you can make a point of information. The detail about how to do so should be found on the back of your order paper, but just to go over it, you can make a point of up to 30 seconds and try to introduce this by saying point of information on that point or kind of indicating. It's entirely up to the speaker if they take that point, so if they keep speaking, they don't see you, or they say no thank you, please respect that, and there will be another chance to make a point in the floor rounds. Alternatively, they may say yes, in which case, please wait for a steward to just get a microphone to you so that everyone else can hear you and also anyone watching online. Make your point, and please remember to keep it up to 30 seconds. Then the other opportunity to make a point will come after the first pair of speakers and second pair of speakers have spoken. I'll ask for points in proposition, opposition, and also abstention of the motion. Points in abstention will be perhaps a point you want to hear further developed, a question about the debate as a whole, or just a challenge to the motion in general. Again, please try to keep your points to 30 seconds maximum and remember to wait for a microphone to reach you. Without further ado, I shall introduce our first speaker on side proposition. Ken Follett is a Welsh author who has sold more than 150 million copies of his works and also a staunch atheist. Ken, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you. Madam President, members of the Union, distinguished guests, I was brought up in a fundamentalist Christian family, and we believed in the literal truth of the Bible, every word. But when I was about 13, my father made the mistake of buying by mail order the Reader's Digest Great World Atlas. And the introduction to the Atlas explained the notion of continental drift, the theory that the continents are like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle that are slowly drifting apart over millions of years. And this obviously contradicted the Bible story that the world was created in 7 days. The evidence for continental drift is slight. There's the shape of the continents, which seem to fit together in an uncanny way. We know that the Earth's crust moves. We can measure its movement, and we believe that that causes earthquakes. But it's not exactly conclusive proof. On the other hand, what is the evidence that the world was created in 7 days? Well, there isn't any, is there? No evidence at all. And I had this argument with my father. Faith is a belief in something for which there is insufficient evidence. The New York Times once said of me that I had faith in a kind of liberal humanism. And liberal humanism is a term which nicely sums up my philosophy of life, but I don't really have faith in it. If something better comes along, I'm ready to switch. And that's the difference between knowledge and religion. If you had a time machine and could go back and say to Galileo, look, you know that the Earth goes around the sun, but we know that the sun moves too. Galileo would say, my goodness, if that's true, I'm going to have to change my cosmology completely. But if you spoke to his tormentor, Pope Paul V, and said, we actually are pretty convinced that Mary was not a virgin when she conceived Jesus Christ, would the Pope say, my goodness, if that's true, I'm going to have to completely change my theology? No, he wouldn't. He would have said, burn that man to death. The debate we're having today has a long history. At around about the time that this distinguished university was being founded, Thomas Aquinas said that we could learn by observing the natural world. He was actually thrown out of the Sorbonne for saying that. Being expelled from a major university is often a good career move, and Aquinas was made a saint, but that was a bit later. At the time, the orthodoxy was that the mind of human beings is too feeble to comprehend God's creation, And our only hope of knowledge is to have faith in divine revelation. That was the orthodoxy. Not long after Aquinas died, something happened which was a turning point in the intellectual history of European civilization. And it was the Black Death, a plague that killed 1 in 3 people in Europe. And the reason that was a turning point in our intellectual history is that it completely undermined people's faith in the priesthood. You see, at that time, all educated doctors were priests, and they were completely helpless to do anything about the plague. The plague vividly dramatized how utterly wrong were the things that priests said to the people. However, there were informal medical practitioners in the 14th century, apothecaries, barber surgeons, nuns, midwives, witches, and they had a more experimental approach. They tried things. They tried putting a mask of linen over the nose and mouth to protect themselves when talking to plague victims. They tried washing their hands in vinegar. They made lists of the little practical things that you could do to protect yourself from this terrible, deadly disease. Those lists were passed around. We call them plague tracts now. They were passed around. They were copied. They were added to. They became the first medical textbooks that were worth anything at all. And they were evidence-based. Nobody had a theory. Nobody consulted a holy book. They just tried to figure out what would work. This led to evidence-based medicine, which led to evidence-based science, which led to the Industrial Revolution. And at the same time that this admittedly very slow process was taking place, European civilization was coming to dominate the world intellectually and economically and politically. At the same time, the argument in the Mediterranean world went the other way. After having led the globe in science and mathematics, the Ottoman Empire turned around, turned against evidence. I have to check. The philosopher Hamid al-Ghazali, excuse me for not remembering that name, the philosopher Hamid al-Ghazali said in the 11th century that scientific inquiry was un-Islamic. And in the Mediterranean world, that argument won the day. And so as the European world became more and more evidence-based, as we lost faith in faith, the Mediterranean world lost faith in evidence, and European science went up and the science of the Middle East and North Africa went down. Now, my friends on the opposite side may say that Follett's approach leaves out the spiritual aspect of life. I would like to say that I do not leave out the spiritual aspect of life. Despite my rejection of the Christian faith, I am a churchgoer. And for me, to sit in a church, my favorite service is choral evening song, and to sit quietly and think in a place where people have been doing that for hundreds of years is a profound spiritual experience. But I do not base a belief system on that spiritual experience. When I was at university in the 1960s, I knew several people who based belief systems on profound spiritual experiences that they had had while taking LSD and listening to Pink Floyd. I'd like to leave you with a quote from a great philosopher of this university, talking about what we might call the spiritual or the ineffable. Ineffable means that you can't express it in words. Possibly the greatest philosopher of this university was Ludwig Wittgenstein, who said, "Whereof we cannot speak, thereof we must remain silent." The grammar is a bit Teutonic, isn't it? I would like to paraphrase what he said by saying, "You can't F the ineffable." I beg to move the motion.
Thank you very much, Ken, for opening Full Side Proposition and the debate as a whole. And now, moving to side opposition, speaking first, we have a spiritual teacher for more than 40 years and leader of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. The floor is now open to His Holiness Radhanath Swami. The floor is now yours, Swami.
Thank you, Madam President and Committee. Ken, thank you for your insightful words and experiences. And gratitude to everyone assembled today. When I was 7 years old, my best friend told me that his parents hate me, and that they told him, God hates me, because I was a Jew. I was vulnerable at 7 years old. My mind went blank. I was deeply hurt and confused. I grew up in the 1960s as a teenager. I shared some of your friends' experiences also, Ken. I saw arrogance, prejudice, superstition, and sometimes hate in the name of a loving God. I too lost faith in faith. I came to a crossroads in my life where I either had to reject religion or I had to find something at the heart of great religions that was in common, something that could transform, something that could help us to love and live with compassion. I left my home as a teenager, hitchhiking through Europe, through the Middle East, to India. In fact, I began from London. It took 6 months to get to India. I studied, I learned from people who were deeply committed to their religions. I found beautiful, inclusive-minded people who really were striving to live with compassion. And I also found many people who had very extreme and narrow views, who considered that their path was the only path, and all others were ignorant or evil. My study brought me to what the Sanskrit Vedic literature is called Saragrahi, which means one who seeks the essence. And I truly found that at the essence of all true spiritual paths in all real practitioners, that there is transformation. Transformation of character, from arrogance to humility, from greed to generosity, from hate to love, complacency to compassion, from selfishness to a selfless will to serve others. That is the core of true faith. Unfortunately, the world we live, we don't see unity in diversity. In the Old Testament, in the New Testament, the great commandment is to love God with all one's heart, soul, and mind, and to love one's neighbor as oneself. everyone is our neighbor. In the Sanskrit text, Srimad Bhagavat, there's a beautiful verse that really touched my heart. Savai pung sang paro dharmo yato bhaktir hokshaje ahoitiki aprati hata yayatma suprasidati. That true religion or dharma is not a sectarian concept. It's that which inspires and awakens from within us love for the Supreme Being and actual compassion for all beings. The Bhagavad Gita tells, Vidyavanaya sampane brahmani gavihastini suni chaiva svapakecha pandita samadarshana. It's the Bhagavad Gita's way of explaining how to love your neighbor as yourself. An actually enlightened person, one who is connected to one's spiritual essence, the testimony is that that person sees all living beings with equal vision. Because we see the spirit, the living force within people. This body is ever changing, and the mind changes much faster. Who am I? Who's seeing through the eyes, hearing through the ears, tasting through the tongue, thinking through the brain, loving through the heart? That conscious force is sacred. When we come in contact with our own sacredness, we see it within life. Whether one is a Hindu or a Muslim or a Jew or a Jain or a Christian or a Parsi, or an agnostic, or a Buddhist, or an atheist, whether one is black or white or yellow or brown, whether one is from the East or the West, male or female, whether one is a human or a dog or a cat or a cow or an elephant, wherever there's life, it is sacred. When we come in contact with the sacredness within our own hearts, who we are, then we can appreciate how, in truth, we are all related. The Bible, Jesus said, what profiteth a person who gains the whole world but loses their eternal soul? Similarly, the Bhagavad Gita tells, Najayate Mriyate Vakadachyat, that the soul, the essence of our life, is beyond birth and beyond death. When we actually can appreciate that within ourselves, we realize that we are caretakers of sacred property. Our abilities, our wealth, the environment around us, it is all sacred property entrusted in our care. And all living beings are part of the same source. We are all related. The character of any true follower of the various great religious paths of the world is that they live with compassion. They live with humility. True spirituality does not divide humanity. It harmonizes humanity. To be an instrument of a higher power, the power of love, the power of compassion, is what true spirituality is to achieve. Science, academics, technology, politics, like religion, can be used with compassion or could be used with arrogance to exploit. 1992, I was driving in Mumbai from a lecture late at night. While I was in the car, Hindu-Muslim riots broke out. The places I was driving, I saw dozens and dozens of buildings blazing on fire. I saw numerous human corpses chopped and stabbed by machetes and knives laying on the roadside. I saw little children screaming, crying, some covered with blood. I remember thinking, in the world we live, there are places where people learn how to hate before they even learn how to reason. At that time, we tried to make a difference. We went to the public schools, some private schools, to teach value education. Universal values of character. And we gave examples for each of these virtues from all the various local religions to actually enlighten the students that we have so much in common. Yes, there are so many things to disagree with based on historical interpretations or explanations, based on rituals, based on language. But what is the essence? To love God, to be an instrument of God's love, to find true joy within our hearts and share that joy with others. If our rituals, if our explanation and our historical evidence does not lead us toward the purpose and the goal of religion, which is to love, which is to share joy, then we're going in the wrong direction. We taught thousands of students, young students, what we all have in common. Because you see, there's a vast segment of the world's population that does believe in one religion or not, or another. To actually help people to understand what is that essential virtue that we all have in common, to respect, to appreciate the unity in our diversity, is a great need of the world. Actually, losing faith in faith could be a great blessing. Because when we lose faith in sectarian, dividing faith, we have a chance to seriously seek real faith, true faith, the essence of all religions. If we don't lose faith in the artificial, we'll never seriously seek what is genuine. That's the story of my life, and I'm very grateful to share it with you today. Thank you.
Thank you very much to His Holiness Radhanath Swami and to both of our speakers for opening tonight's debate. We will now go to the floor round, so it's now the chance for everyone in the room to make a point in proposition, opposition or abstention or any questions you'd like to put to the remaining speakers. So first of all, do we have any points to make in proposition of the motion, "This house has lost faith in faith." Yes, I think we've got one just over here on the left.
Haniel Bay, Trinity College. The problem I have with religion is not necessarily that faith itself is evil, but we can't treat it as an ideal that exists independently of human agency. So faith shouldn't divide, but faith is inherently human, and it's misused. In practice, it creates dichotomy after dichotomy. The right belief, the right God, the wrong God, the right way to live, the wrong way to live, the right person to love, the wrong person to love. Faith is dangerous because it doesn't exist in a vacuum, and because it has so much power over people. It has such a sway over people's lives. So if all humanity were as enlightened as His Holiness, I would have every faith in faith. Not in organized religion, but at least in faith. However, in practice, I can't have faith in faith because I don't have faith in human nature.
Thank you very much for that point. And now moving to points in opposition of the motion. Would anyone like to make a point in opposition to "This house has lost faith in faith"? I think we have one just in the second row here.
Aidan Chan, Jesus College. I think it's important to separate faith from religion sometimes, because they're not exactly the same, because religion comes with the whole lifestyle and, you know, the ethical and moral part of it, whereas faith can be anything from, like, a good luck charm or crossing your fingers or touch wood or something. It's, as the first speaker of the proposition said, it's ineffable. You can't say, I don't think that crossing my fingers is actually going to make any difference, but I do it anyway. And so I often think of faith in a religious context as just a bigger good luck charm, or a God luck charm, if you will. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your point. And finally, do we have any in abstention of the motion, any questions that people would like to put? I think we have one here, just in the blue shirt there, if someone with a microphone.
Hello. I just wanted to make a point about the nature of faith. In the macro sense, we've been focusing a lot upon religion tonight, but in the macro sense, faith is complete trust or confidence in someone or something. And I think in that regard, everyone has an element of faith in their lives and is faithful in some way. It can change. Of course, we can shift paradigms and believe in different things, but we always believe in something. I believe it was Stephen Hawking that said, no matter how bad things may seem, there's always something you can do and succeed at. Where there is life, there will always be hope. Thank you.
Thank you very much for all of those points there. And now we'll move back to the debate, but there'll be a second opportunity to make points from the floor after the next pair of speakers. Continuing full side proposition, we have Sadia Hamid. Sadia is a spokesperson for the Council of Ex-Muslims of Britain. Sadia, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Some very, very interesting points have been made so far. So it's incredibly difficult to have faith in faith, particularly when there are so many horrors in the world that aren't of our making. Innocent children dying of cancer, the spread of HIV and AIDS, malaria, polio, and the recent Ebola crisis, just to name but a few. But only since evidence-based medicine, vaccines and practice have we begun to manage these afflictions, whilst the church and religious bodies have fought them every step of the way. So, for example, the church contested the use of epidurals, arguing that suffering is supposed to be a part of childbirth. Labour pain is said to be part of God's curse to Eve, for the sin of eating the forbidden fruit. A mother in labour shouldn't try to mitigate this discomfort, because requesting an epidural is like nullifying God's righteous judgment. The church has consistently opposed research into embryonic stem cells. Conversely, scientists have asked for greater research in this area because they believe that they exhibit greater pluripotency, which is the ability to divide into different types of cells rather than, say, adult stem cells. Stem cells are among the body's most versatile components, reservoirs capable of growing into virtually any other human tissue. The church contests this because embryonic cell stem research entails the destruction of an embryo, and they feel this is morally wrong. They equate the destruction of a mass of cells to the taking of a human life. Furthermore, scientists use cloning to produce embryos in order to harvest cells. And although these embryos are created in a lab environment, the church contests that personhood begins at conception and hence opposes this line of research too. They argue that embryonic stem cell investigations begin with the ending of human life. In a similar manner, certain sects of Christianity have contested the development and the use of vaccines because some common inoculations have been made using cell lines derived from voluntarily aborted human fetuses. The church has said, quote, abortion is a grave crime against innocent human life. We should always ask our physician whether the product he proposes to use has a historical association with abortion, and we should ask for an alternative. The Church of Christ and the Dutch Reformist Church have both been known to refuse vaccinations, stating that they interfere with one's relationship with God and that only God can decide when somebody lives or dies. The Church of Christ states that disease is not fundamentally real, but rather something that can be dispelled to reveal the perfection of God's creation. And although the church advises to use alternative vaccinations, at present there's no alternative for rubella, chickenpox, or hepatitis A. I find it incredibly sinister that a deity that we should have faith in continues to test that faith in the most untrusting of manners. If it was a relationship, it would be considered controlling and abusive. The church has also opposed the use of contraception in places like Africa, where there are HIV and AIDS epidemics. The church has said things like, yes, of course AIDS is bad, but condoms are worse. The church suggests that contraception should be limited to married couples who are using it to regulate the size and spacing of their family. They often teach that using contraception to prevent children altogether is not desirable. And it's similar to what's taught in Islam. In Islam, they suggest that you breastfeed for a period of 2 years so that you don't take any form of contraception. Science gives women control over their bodies and their futures. Religious organizations and faith groups aim to reinstate those controls. The church teaches that using artificial contraception is wrong because it is against natural law. It breaks the natural connection between procreative and unitive purposes of sex. It turns sex into a non-marital act. It gives human beings the power to decide when a new life should begin, and that power only belongs to God. It leads to widespread immorality, damages the institution of marriage, reduces male respect for women, and it gives human beings the idea that they have complete control over their bodies. Research conducted in 2006 evidenced the lack of power of prayer. They found that prayers offered by strangers had no effect on the recovery of patients undergoing heart surgery. On the contrary, patients who knew they were receiving prayer fared worse than those who were not prayed for. They were at higher risk of post-operative complications, like abnormal heart rhythms, because of the expectation and anxieties that the prayer created, that this person is praying for me and I should be getting better, but I'm not.
Hi, my name is Madison, Sydney, Sussex.
Hi.
Hi, I was just wondering where you got that statistic, because I've read other statistics that have stated that prayer has been proven actually to reduce stress and anxiety. Thank you.
So this is a 2006 study. I'm sure if you find it yourself, you look for it yourself, you'll find it. It's pretty easy to come across on the internet. So in Britain, just this September, another study revealed that the proportion of non-believers is at record highs, with over half the population in Britain having no faith at all. On a personal level, a lack of faith has given me the courage to question everything. 15 years ago, when I was questioning my faith, I'd never heard of the term ex-Muslim. Today, our organisation has just short of 600 people on record that we're actively providing support for. And we're just one organisation. There's countless partners of ours across the world providing countless individuals with support. Many of our members have been taught not to question anything to do with their faith. On becoming ex-Muslims, we have learnt to question and critique everything. We start from scratch, and we don't believe anything without reasonable evidence.
Roy and Kyrie, ARU. So, saying about ex-Muslim, saying an ex-Muslim, what would you say about the, questioning your faith? As my understanding and my fellow other Muslims in my community, we're encouraged to question our faith and question, why certain things happen and question phrases in the Quran and the stories that we've been brought up with, to question them and make our own decision. We're encouraged to make our own decision, not, be indoctrinated, essentially, what you're trying to suggest.
So what would happen if you left Islam? What would be the penalty for apostatizing?
So the penalty of leaving Islam, so you're saying to becoming an atheist?
Yeah.
Depending on what country, depending what country.
What does the Quran say?
Quran, death.
Thank you very much. So scientists don't mind being proven wrong. In fact, it opens up debate and avenues for research. I have to say, I don't mind being proven wrong. I've changed my mind on so many things, and I'm quite happy to change my mind. It's something that becoming an atheist allowed me, actually, as being a Muslim, I was restricted from asking questions. Faith-based communities do their utmost to control access to education or resources that may strain members away from their faith. A recent example of this was we had a documentary released last year called Islam's Non-Believers, where we talked about our reasons for leaving Islam. The community leaders had advised members of those communities that if there's anybody in your community that is unsure, keep them away from this documentary because otherwise they will apostatize and leave Islam. Averroes Ibn Rushd, in his time, suggested that ask questions, question everything, a concept so dangerous that they started burning his books. Evidence-based practice, medicine, and science has improved our lives in so many ways.
Hello, Vic Sharma. I'm an independent researcher. traditionally, if you look at the history of Islam and the development of hospitals, the word hospital is actually an Arabic word. It comes from an ancient or a medieval tradition of Islamic people who actually were translating information from Galen and Hippocrates, and some of the world's first hospitals existed in the Arab world where Islam was actually practiced. So what we have here and what you're doing is there's a departure of understanding historically, and there's also a departure of understanding from what we have as modern day history and medieval and ancient history. And therefore, we should also note that if you do look at Quranic references, we have the word Allah appearing as I'm not a Muslim, but I just do history. We know that this word appears the most inside the Quran, and the second word that appears mostly inside the Quran is actually the word ilm, which means to have logic and to have scientific inquiry. And therefore, this theology, it's indeed a theology, it has some scientific basis. And there's a huge interpretation on the scientific world which is coming from that. Later, those Greek texts were translated into Arabic and then came back to the Western world as what we call as modern-day, modern-day medicine, from the fathers of that. So the point is that it's not religion that is not, you know, the advocate of, you know, suppressing science and these kind of things in medicine. And what you're trying to convey here is that religion is actually trying to, you know, shed the ideas of modern-day medicine, and actually the roots of that were slightly different.
Do you want to go on?
I'll do a point of order. Okay. It's where you claimed, or should I stand up? It's Adjan Vaughan, Emmanuel, because I studied here. I still remember there. So first of all, they're to say that hospitals are started in the Middle East or in Arab culture. 2,500 years ago, there were thriving hospitals in the Buddhist tradition. There was many, many places. And even there was one evidence in those scriptures, by the way, of brain surgery 2,500 years ago. So I think it's a bit of a not quite accurate to say that hospitals started in Arab culture. Sorry? Yeah. Well, I was I was quoting 2,500 years ago. So that's
I think we'll have to return back to Sadia now, but we can do more discussion in the main debate.
Actually, I was nearly done. So I think I'll end there. The only other thing I had to ask Swamiji, actually, you talked about how religion and love go hand in hand. So my question naturally is, do you think that those that have no faith don't have the capacity to love or show compassion or show humanity or lack morals? Because I know for a fact our foundation as an organization is one based entirely on human rights. You know, we want equality for everybody, but we're irreligious, we're, you know, heretics. That was my only question to you, but that's where I'll end, I guess.
Well, thank you very much to Sadia and for all that made sense. Moving now back to the opposition bench, we have our next speaker, Virginia Moffat. Virginia is a writer and associate of the belief-based think tank Ecclesia. She's also an author with her upcoming book, released this November. Virginia, the floor is now yours. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me. It's really wonderful to be here, and I've really enjoyed listening to this very, very interesting debate. I'm going to make three points on my side of the argument, I'm going to tell you what those three points are, and then I'll just expand on them each in turn. The first point I want to make is that faith remains important to many people, so I don't think it can be easily dismissed. My second point is there might be a sense that faith has been lost because I think the nature of faith has changed in this country, but I don't think that means faith has been lost. I think it's changed. And my third point is, and I think it captures on some things you were talking about, Sadia, is that the faith in the institutions isn't the same thing as faith itself. And we might have lost faith in the institutions for very, very good reasons, but actually faith remains very important. So my first point, and again, I'm going to pick on something you said, is to acknowledge you're absolutely right. People of faith are no longer in the majority in this country. 53% of the British people no longer have a faith. But actually, 47% of the people still do. And I'd say that's quite a significant number. It's not too far off the numbers of people who voted Remain. And I think if anybody suggested the Remain vote was insignificant, I think they'd have a bit of having a fight in their hands. So I'd like to pick up why that 47% of people find faith important. I think it's something you were talking about, that faith can give a sense of connection and help of belonging to the community. My faith community is my church, Our Ladies in Cowley. And Our Ladies in Cowley has been on this particular site for 50 years, but it's part of a Christian congregation that's been there for nearly 100. And there's a local school that my children used to go to. And when we used to walk to school in the morning when they were small, we used to often meet parishioners and nuns coming up to some weekday mass. And they would always stop and talk. And we had a really wonderful sense of people in our community really caring about us as a family, interested in their daily lives, and actually then going off to pray for us. And I'm not somebody who thinks prayer is about making us better, but it's about prayer being held by somebody else and other people thinking about us. And I don't think that that's uncommon. I think that other faith groups would say they had similar encounters in the street. And I actually think it's something that people who don't have a faith, I mean, you mentioned it yourself, Ken, that going to church can be very helpful even if you don't have a faith. And I think that's why we've seen the rise of Sunday assemblies. And I think that's really great that secular people want to replicate that thing that faith groups can bring together. The second thing I think that faith can bring is it can help us mark the important parts of our lives. From birth, we have in the Christian church, which is my church, we have baptism. But there are naming ceremonies in many religious services, and I think that, and actually lots of humanist naming services as well. And I think it's a really great way of starting out in life. And there are these markers throughout our lives. There are also ceremonies and rituals that we come back to, and different feasts that we come back to year on year. And I find some great comfort of, we're just about to approach Advent, and I love the Advent season. At the moment, again in the Catholic Church, we're in November, and in November we remember all the dead. And we write the names in a book. And I did it on Sunday. And I was carrying on a tradition that my father did, and his father did, and his father did. And I feel very connected not only with my father, but with all the people that I've known, that I've loved and lost. The final thing I think that faith can do, and I think this is good faith, because I recognise you've all had experiences of bad faith communities. A good faith community does sustain us. It helps us through the highs and lows. And I know that some communities harm and damage, but my community really, really helps me with my life. And I think the majority of good faith communities are places where, as we sang in church on Sunday, the attitude is, brother, sister, let me serve you. That's what people of faith should be doing. We should be serving each other and then going out to serve the world. That's our job. I think the second point I want to make is, just because the nature of faith might have changed in this country, it doesn't mean it's been lost. That British Attitude Survey and many others have shown that the biggest decline in faith in this country is the Church of England. And this isn't just to highlight the Church of England. I think many of the Christian churches have witnessed the decline. But it was the biggest church, so it's got the biggest decline. And one of the things you might comment on that is that the Church of England has in the past perhaps been a very white and monocultural church, and we're a much more diverse country, and that's a really good thing. I think that, in fact, Catholicism, the evidence suggests that Catholicism hasn't had a similar decline, mainly because of the influx of migrants, and the Catholic Church being an international church, that's kept our population stable. And I think that's a really good thing as well. My church community now has 40 nationalities, and it makes it a very rich and vibrant place to go. But while some multicultural faiths have been declining, others have been growing. So the rise in faiths communities and Christian churches at the moment is in the black evangelical community, because they are growing because they've got an energy and passion they're not seeing in traditional church. The Muslim Council of Britain has said that there's been a growth of mosques in recent years, and it's not necessarily on the scale that the Daily Mail would have us believe, to terrify us, but actually I think that's a really positive thing. People want to become Muslim. And actually the fastest rising religion at the moment is Buddhism. And I'd also argue that the recent interest in mindfulness suggests that people are searching for some kind of spiritual understanding, some kind of trying to find a way and a path through this very confusing world we live in. And so what I think is happening is we're moving from a place where one single faith dominated our landscape to one that there are multiple faiths and none, and those of no faith are in the majority. And I think if you're a very hardline religious person, you might be frightened by that, but I welcome it. I think it's really wonderful, because it means that we all have we can have conversations with each other, because none of us have the monopoly on the truth, and there is much we can all learn from each other. I'm an associate for Ecclesia, the Christian think tank, And we've sought in recent years to promote this idea of understanding and learning from each other. And if you look at Ecclesia, that's often many of the things that we write about. We've had a number of talks that we've had with people of all faith and none on subjects such as sexuality, faith and resistance, Muslim-Christian relationships, and is the right to offend sacred, which was a really, really good one. We're not alone in that. Greenbelt, the Christian Arts Festival, has long had a platform for many, many voices. And I was really pleased to see that Reformed Judaism has launched a Christian, not a Christian, sorry, Jewish-Muslim initiative this year. So being in a multi-faith society, that means tonight I can stand here and do something that was unheard of when I was born, which is stand with my Muslim and Krishna brothers and talk about something that we have in common and understand and believe together. Because I think we're right. We have more in common than separates us. And my final point, I think it kind of links to some things you've been talking about, is losing faith in institutions isn't the same as losing faith. I'm 52, and in my lifetime, I've seen all the great institutions fall by the wayside. When I was a kid, the bank manager was held in high regard, the MP was held in high regard, the vicar was held in high regard, the police, the media, all of those institutions have crumbled because they failed us. And that's what happens to institutions, because I think, as somebody's already said, institutions are human. But for people of faith, that shouldn't be terrifying. That's actually really, really exciting. Because the Old Testament prophets were not inclined to wander in the king's palace unless they came with a rebuke. Jesus did not mix with the rich and powerful except to challenge them. The early Christian communities were not places of power, but places of resistance where people shared in common. And so when faith moves away from being part of the centre of the elite, it goes back to where it should be, in the margins, standing with the widow, standing with the orphan, standing with the poor, standing with the oppressed. And I want to make a point that I don't believe, the point you were making, that means that people of faith have some kind of moral high ground, because they don't. We're just part of this very diverse pattern of people, and we can all work together on many, many issues. So what I would argue is that people of faith can contribute to making the world's best place, alongside people who have no faith, and we do that better when we work together and say, let's put our differences aside and see what the issues are. So for that reason, this year I've edited an essay collection called Reclaiming the Common Good, where I brought together a number of Christian writers who looked at issues like migration, austerity, and economics, and made suggestions about how we can make the world a better place. For that reason, I really welcome when religious leaders speak out. My own Archbishop Vincent Nichols condemned welfare cuts as a disgrace. The Archbishop of Canterbury recently talked about the importance of having a more just and fair economics. And last year, Jewish, Muslim and Christian leaders joined together to condemn the government's actions on the Calais jungle. But not only that, people of faith act. And again, I want to emphasise, people of no faith also act, and I think it works better when we do it together. But I think with many of the crises that are happening in this country together, if you find hungry people, you find food banks. And I don't think food banks are a good thing, but they are being run in response to need, and many of them are being run by religious groups, many of them being run by non-religious groups too. People of faith are coming together, as they did in Derby, to bring out night shelters to respond to the closure of night shelters. People of faith are also attacking the causes of those injustices, such as campaigning against austerity and welfare cuts, and campaigning for a living wage. Some of you may have followed recently the Dicey Conference in London, which is a big arms fair. There was 8 days of wonderful protests where the work of the conference was disrupted. On one of those days, so there were 7 days that it wasn't people of faith, but on one of those days, people of faith came together and had what was described as the biggest Quaker meeting in the street, 200 people who prayed in the street and stopped the lorries coming. Meanwhile, people were abseiling, people were being locked on and being arrested for protesting about the arms fair for their faith. And I want to end up with two more peace protesters who are driven by their faith, who you again might have heard of recently. Sam Walton, who's a Quaker, and the Rev. Daniel Woodson, who's a Methodist, were recently acquitted of charges of attempting to disarm a plane that would have gone to Saudi Arabia. The reason that they broke into British airspace to try and do that was the plane would have been used to bomb people in Yemen, and we all know what's happening in Yemen and our complicity in that. And as Sam said in court, everyone is unique and a special child of God. We are equal and connected. To destroy a human being is to destroy a part of God. It was enough to sway the judge who acquitted them. And I suggest it's enough for most of us to accept that there is something about faith that we can all get behind. And that is why I propose that this House has not lost faith in faith, but an outdated concept of what faith might mean. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Virginia, for continuing the debate for side opposition. We will now go to our final floor round. So would anyone from upstairs or downstairs like to make a point in proposition of the motion? Yes, just here in the dungarees. If there's a microphone that could be sent across, please.
Hi, I'm Joanna from Pembroke. I was raised... Can everyone hear me? Yeah.
Yeah.
I was raised Catholic, and I lost my faith around about the age of 12 or 13. So this is, you know, a relevant motion to me, and I just wanted to make two points in the side of proposition that I don't think have been properly touched on. The first is that most of the speakers have separated, and quite rightly, faith from organised religion. And faith on kind of an individual, personal level can, I think, be a comfort and can help an individual person. You could also say that it leads to, you know, a lack of curiosity. It inspires a kind of sureness, even a chronic optimism in people. Although, whether or not you agreed with that, I think the real issue with that kind of personal faith is that it does, as someone said before, it doesn't exist in a vacuum. People that have faith want to share it. People discuss ideas. People don't make up their spirituality. Ideas are shared. And when that happens, it can be exploited, and people can use it as a means of control of other people. And I wanted to kind of make that point that personal faith is very much connected to organized religion. Because at the end of the day, isn't that what organised religions are made up of? So that brings me on to the next point I wanted to make, which was that that kind of legitimising of personal faith has very dire real-world consequences. One example, was in America. I can't tell you exactly where I went off the top of my head, but again, as one of the speakers said, Google is your friend. There was a church in America where, there's an area in America where the hospital were campaigning for medical marijuana to be allowed because the patients, you know, felt that they really needed that for their schizophrenia or other illnesses that marijuana can help. But because of the legislation in the area, they were not allowed that. No matter what they tried to do, they were not allowed their medical marijuana. However, the local church said, we think that marijuana gives us a spiritual connection to God that no one else can understand. They were allowed the marijuana. Faith can be used as a political tool to legitimize things. And that's kind of one kind of silly example, but it can have much huger effects. For example, who could stand up and justify homophobic legislation for any reason other than faith? They'd just be called a bigot. But if you say, God is telling me, the Bible is telling me, look, it's written down in this, you know, several thousand-year-old document, then people, particularly, for example, in America, have their faith in that Bible, and that is going to be, like, that is much more likely to be allowed. And you might say, well, I've got faith, and, you know, I'm... like, very pro-LGBT, and, you know, I have friends that are Christian that are very liberal, and there is certainly precedent for that in the Bible, but that doesn't matter to somebody who has political power and is going to use their faith and the faith of others to push their political or bigoted agenda. I can't think of anything other than religion that would back that up in a courtroom or in a political sphere. That was quite a long-winded point, but thank you.
Thank you. I'm now going to go to points in opposition. Are there raised hands to start making points in opposition? It looks like we've got quite a few. So what I will do is try to take, let's take one just on the left there. And then if there's time, if the first one is quick, then I'll take another. So if you want to take one just there with the microphone.
Yeah, thank you. What I wanted to bring out was the definition of evidence that seems to occur in a vacuum here. What exactly is being put forward as evidence and reason? Is it the evidence within the framework of logical positivism that only scientific or logical truths can be considered valid? Well, this has been almost universally dismissed by the vast majority of philosophers of science and epistemologists. What is the definition in which evidence is being put forward? I think that it's a very problematic notion that we're being presented with. And, for example, with string theory, there is no positive evidence that can suggest it. Its validity derives not from the positivistic evidence, but from the internal coherence. There are completely different epistemologies in which evidence can be defined. And within that, there is also this complete breakdown, and I'm surprised they haven't pointed it out, between faith is based on nothing and evidence is based on something really tangible. But as Hume showed with the problem of induction, belief in the scientific method is itself based on a belief in cause and effect, which cannot be proven from the world itself, but is an assumption, a belief system that we bring to the world in order to do science. So this breakdown between faith and evidence is complete crap. All worldviews are built on a series of assumptions that cannot themselves be proven, or else you'd end up with an infinite regression. The question is which series of presuppositions we are going to adopt and which ones we're not. And with that, I think the evidentialist perspective that you seem to be adopting on this side assumes a hell of a lot that cannot be proven. One, that the world is rational. Two, that our minds are rational, which took thousands of years for us to figure out. Three, that there is a correspondence as such that the mind can access the world without being hindered by the filters of society and the categories that we impose on the world, which is a hell of a lot of assumptions that philosophers are still really debating today. I really don't think you've defined or provided a definition of evidence or of reason that is satisfactory. And I'd also kind of disappointed in this side for not questioning that and reevaluating what faith means as if there was a way in which we could live without presuppositions. Anyways, thank you.
Thank you for your point. There is
perhaps
a right of reply.
Perhaps a point of information: with all your doubts about evidence, I wonder why you thought that microphone was going to work.
I'm moving now. We will have to move to points in abstention of the motion for reasons of time. But again, do remember that you can finally raise points as abstentions in the final pair of speakers. So in abstention of the motion, again, there are lots of hands. If we could just go to over here, please.
Sarah from Homerton. I just wanted to point out that it seemed that both sides focused the bulk of their arguments on the results, the outcomes of people having faith, rather than the nature of the faith itself. So in philosophy, we talk about pragmatic encroachment, weighting a belief on the outcome of what that belief will have on your life. So whether you are a good person or a bad person, whether you support evidence-based medicine or not, and that it should be separated from determining whether faith is true or not, even whether you believe there is a capital T true, or whether it has substance in it of itself. And I would like to ask both sides to perhaps touch on that a little bit more in the final speeches.
Thank you. We will now move to the final pair of speakers, and thank you to everyone who hasn't made a point so far. To close the case for side proposition, we have Ajahn Brahm. Ajahn is a British Theravada Buddhist monk and the abbot of a monastery in Western Australia. Ajahn, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Excellent. I began my journey in theoretical physics here a long time ago. So I'm still a member of Emmanuel College, and it's wonderful to be here. But first of all, I'm a Buddhist, an atheist, and a scientist. And I always keep in mind some of the foundation of the scientific method, which may be answering your idea of evidence-based. And that was that from Francis Bacon, who was one of the founders of the Royal Society, who said that we put up a proposition and we do our damnedest to try and argue against it, to try and prove its faults and fallacies. Not only does that give us some growth, but it also puts aside ideas, propositions, which have too many flaws in it. There is a perception that we should follow truth, and truth is something which is always going to be work in action, never finished, but we also use to challenge, to find the faults in, and that has always been where in science, and also in religion, we have been able to make great progress. So first of all, is a commitment to truth, and is an understanding that that truth will be beneficial to people. And of course, it's not just in the UK that many people are losing faith in organized religions. And when people ask me, well, what about Buddhism? Please, Buddhism is not a religion. Sometimes we say it is a religion, but that's usually for tax purposes only. But it's a religion which doesn't have a belief in a God or a permanent soul. It doesn't fit in. So first of all, I want to make the point that we don't believe in a God, a creator God, in Buddhism, which made it acceptable to keep my science, to keep my brain as well as my heart. And it's also not true, as far as I understand it, that you have to have a belief in a supreme being to have love and compassion. And in fact, I believe really it's the opposite. That an idea of a supreme being, a monarch, somebody who is in the top, the peak of control of us, to which we must submit. The idea of submission has been the cause of so many problems in our society. And evidence-based, I think, you know, there has to be some idea of not doubting something which is pretty, pretty true. Always go to Occam's razor, which is not definitive, but it is a working proposition, the simplest solution, the evidence-based. The evidence is showing, proving, indicating in that area we can find some truth and some growth. And the Occam's razor is that a belief in a supreme being passes the buck. It's God's will. It's God's fault. And that was never that very clearly and good with me. And of course, there's absolutely no proof at all of a God. When you say ineffable, ineffable means you don't know. I always was very inspired by Werner Heisenberg. Werner Heisenberg is quoted as saying, you all know he was one of the great founders of quantum physics, quantum science, which is supposed to be one of the most difficult parts of science to understand. And he was saying that if you really understand quantum physics, quantum science, then you can explain it to the person serving you a pint of beer in the pub. In other words, your ability to explain something is a measure of your understanding of it. And that was always one of the reasons why you rejected what we call the organized religions, organized faith. And I think that you can't really say that, well, there's a difference between the organized religions and faith. To me, just listening to that, it's similar, not exactly the same, but similar to the ideas, guns don't kill, people do. It's not religion's the fault, it is that people just don't use them rightly. And I think the evidence is indicating something else, which is one of the reasons, not just in Australia and UK, even in Australia, the latest census showed that the growth of no religion, moving away from religion, is the fastest growing belief even in Australia. So that is also here in UK, and there's a reason for that. Basically, people have lost their faith because, number one, They can't justify it intellectually. And number two, it doesn't work. When those two things come together, the fact that intellectually, scientifically, philosophically, it's very hard to maintain a belief in what we know as religion, and even faith in a God, in a creator, in an all-powerful being, that is not necessary. It just really makes it very difficult to be honest to your intellect, and also you don't need it to be have a good heart and be very compassionate. I think Buddhists are pretty well known around the world. They're not perfect, but we are pretty compassionate and kind people. So because of that, you know, that we don't need a belief in a supreme being or a faith in something to be kind, to be compassionate. So separating compassion from faith. Yes.
Angus Robinson from Trinity. And you might say that it is equivalent, that faith is only equivalent to belief in a supreme God. But when you are performing those acts of compassion as a Buddhist, is that not, does that not need as a basis some sort of faith in the general good of humanity, in the general trustworthiness and worthiness of human nature, in order for that action to have any meaning whatsoever?
No, it does not. There is a natural tendency of human beings. People who have no religion, never been to school, who never been, please excuse me, but indoctrinated in a particular type of belief system or culture. Some of those people are naturally kind. And sometimes it is the beliefs which actually stop people being kind, which actually hinder it. That is my experience. So I disagree with you there. And that's my evidence base of personal experience. And that is also an important part of evidence, personal experience. Can I ask another one? Yes, go on.
You say that often it's the beliefs that are causing the lack of compassion, but if it is a kind of dogmatic set of beliefs, you know, Westboro Baptist Church saying, go to hell if you don't do this, this is what you need to do, does that really fit with the definition of faith that we started this debate with? That faith is about saying, you know what, we don't have this kind of traditional evidence, but this is what I reckon it's going to be. I'd say that the kind of dogmatic, negative, controlling kind of religion is that that says to people, you should not come up with your own ideas. You should not see what it is you have faith in. This is what you should do. And what we've heard from the opposition are people saying, not you should do this, but this is what I feel is right, and these are the things in which I have faith. And when we think about faith like that, I think we probably get a nicer kind of faith, and a faith in which we can probably have faith. Thank you.
I think one of the flaws in that argument, sir, is that we always think that, yes, faith is not the problem. We can just tweak it. We can actually make it more free, more liberal, and less confined, you know, by dogmas or traditional religions. But it's not the case. That faith, the belief without supporting evidence, which is not just scientific evidence, personal, experiential, I think that is the problem. So instead of having faith, now we have inquiry. Faith is almost like a belief in defiance of reason, a lazy acceptance of some idea without really pushing it further. One of the reasons I loved this university was because we were taught always to question, in my day anyway. There's a saying which I learnt here, where everybody thinks the same, no one thinks at all. And some of that faith stops inquiry. So if you have faith in no faith, fine.
Josh Kimlin, Christ College.
Yes.
On that idea of people where everybody thinks the same, nobody thinks at all, I ought to let you know that I work for Varsity. I'm going to get a sack for this. You might be interested to know that Varsity will never print a pro-life piece. They will never print a piece in favour of abortion. During my time at Varsity, I've been there for a year and a half now, at least four pitches have come in along that view saying, why don't we have this debate? And they say no. So this idea that the rationalist secularists are, flip around, the idea that the faith-based people are the only people being dogmatic is perhaps open to question itself.
Yeah. Indeed. Well, even talking about science, I know that science can be dogmatic. I think even science has lost its way because it doesn't challenge enough. When I was here in the Cavendish Laboratory, which has been moved since I was here, there was a saying on the wall, the eminence of a great scientist is measured by the length of time they obstruct progress in their field. And I think that is part of the idea of faith. Faith in authority. And sometimes the ultimate authority, if it's a God, a supreme being, a supreme patriarch, and how many religions are run and led by men? So there's a big problem there with our faith groups, but already it's not just, we haven't even got round to LGBTQ communities. We haven't even looked after and loved compassionately women. Where are the female leaders in Islam, in Christianity, in Hinduism, even in Buddhism? I've been fighting hard, and I'm very proud to say that I was thrown out of the monastery where I started because I ordained nuns. And there's one sitting over there who was bhikkhuni, fully ordained women. So that's love, that's compassion. You can't just accept the status quo and say that you love. You fight for it. And you're willing to sacrifice for it. You serve. But not because you believe in a supreme being. Not out of faith. Because you know it's right. Yeah.
Go on. The only note I'd make now is as we get towards the end of the evening, they must be 30 seconds or less.
Okay, thank you. You've quite rightly mentioned that, you know, faith is, you know, kind of not necessary. But you've also become ordained as a monk, and you've said the three jewels of the Buddhist tradition, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. You've committed your faith to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha.
No.
And also, faith, which in itself is you have to invest your faith in this ideology to be able to do that for a start, and faith is also a metaphysical concept. You can't mix it up with things that are actually based in the physical reality. It's a different discipline. Science is a different discipline to psychology, although there's parameters that meet. But there are different disciplines like history and everything, and the discipline is different. So when you go into the metaphysical world, you study spirituality and philosophy that exists in a different paradigm. It has to be discussed in a different format, and you yourself have just kind of defeated your own self by actually surrendering yourself into the life of Buddha and presenting your faith there.
Well, that is totally untrue, inaccurate. An assumption ridden. Buddhism don't even believe in a self, a permanent entity, a self. And it's interesting that when there is an ultimate God, there's always an ultimate part of the human being. You know that it was the Greeks who developed the word atom. An atom was the indivisible, essential part of matter. And this fellow Rutherford, over in the Cavendish, here in this university, split the atom and found it wasn't fundamental. It wasn't just the basic part of this human being. In Sanskrit Pali, we have the word atma, which is the same root as atom, the idea of an indivisible, unitary thing which makes up this soul, this stream of consciousness, as I say in Buddhism. And that was split up, challenged, as what the Rutherford was to the physical, the stuff of this world, people like the Buddha was to the spiritual world. Questioning, defeating. So I did not submit to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, to the Triple Gem. The whole point of Buddhism, people just assume it's the same as any other faith, any other religion. It is a non-faith. It's a challenge. It always was, always will be. Yeah? No, great.
I'm just wondering why Buddhism is exempt from the kind
Yeah. It is the people who are creating violence in Myanmar. They're, by the very definition, the very essence, they're not Buddhists. They're not Buddhist practitioners. They identify with an idea without really understanding what it truly is. So I reject them as being Buddhists. If you're an atheist and you believe in the Supreme Being, you're not an atheist. So if you believe in such violence, then you're not a real Buddhist. I'm sorry, but that's the answer there. Yeah. Yes, they aren't. They're not practicing Buddhists. So you disown them? You disown them. In other words, they're human beings, distorted, deceived, not really understanding what's going on. Because of that lack of questioning. Yeah. This, remember that the history of Myanmar was one which was dominated by the military government for so many years. You know, out of fear, there hasn't been much growth. Much understanding, no ability to question. The hierarchies were very, very strong. So they're just basically coming of age, doing it really terribly. Hopefully in the future, they will be able to be real Buddhists.
Yeah. I'm afraid we're now in the final minute of speech, so there's no more time for interventions in this speech.
Okay.
But, Brahm, if you'd like to make your closing remarks.
Okay. It is, there must be a reason if you respect the human beings in most educated, advanced countries. Why is it that people are moving away from faith? I think that is pretty sure evidence-based, and I think it would be very hard to actually argue against that. So people are moving away. And it's, when you said it's only 53%, 75% of those who are still maintaining faith are elderly. Young people are moving away from faith, from all faiths. And this is one of the problems. Why? Because faith promises much and delivers little. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much to Ajahn Brahm for completing Foreside Proposition. And now for the final speaker for opposition and the debate as a whole, we have Asad Dunner. Asad is a board member of Iman, Europe's biggest charity supporting LGBTQI Muslims. Ajahn, the floor is yours.
So, as a Muslim, I'm going to start with a confession. I am a believer. So I'm going to borrow a term from Justin Bieber. Is it too late now to say sorry? Because I was brought up, or taught by Mr. Monk, my Year 10 RE teacher, Mr. Monk, his real name, that Buddhism was a religion. And I'm glad that I've learned something new today. So thank you for correcting that. And I'm sorry for not knowing the truth. And I'm also sorry about the evidence-based argument, because you put that in a way that I probably can't do, and actually I hadn't planned to do, but you did it. So thank you, because it was a really, really good argument. But I think what we've heard today in this room and in this chamber is that we have defined religion quite early on as an institution, and an institution that we've lost faith in. And I think that's pretty fair, despite the fact that more people are doing the Hajj and the pilgrimage, despite the fact that in other areas of the world religion is growing. I don't have stats, I haven't Googled it. But there is a sense that in Western Europe we have lost faith in faith as an institution. And that's totally fair. But then we've also lost faith in something else, and that's in individuals. We've lost faith in the individuals who lead these organizations and these institutions, those demagogues. And if we took that broader sense of institution, we go beyond religion, we look at organizations, corporate companies, we look at governments, I think it's fair to say that we have lost faith in people running those institutions as a whole. And so the question there is, well why? Why, you know, people like Hamid Al-Ghazali, who didn't know the word hospital, Why did he make that aspersion about Islam not being compatible with science and the two not working together? Well, I guess it's something to do with ego. I think we're living right now in a society where the ego seems to be ruling supreme. We've got forward-facing cameras. We've got selfies. We've got like buttons. We've got Facebook. We can build these great big egos. And the people doing that are the individuals leading these institutions that we are bandying around with this term faith. So I think we can all agree, really, that faith as an institution has kind of fallen foul to the fact that the ego has become so big. And that would be an amazing motion. This house has lost faith to the ego. But that's not what we're here to debate today. What we're here to debate today is that faith as a concept is something we've lost. And I feel that's really sad. I think that as individuals alone, we can be agents for good. And if we lose that faith, then what are we doing? Why are we here? And I think without it, we lose hope. And there was a beautiful comment from the floor, which was, where there is life, there is hope. And I think that's what faith is about. I think faith is about that hope. So there are kind of four areas of faith where I start to think, okay, well, we must have faith in these four areas of what faith should be. And one of them is faith in individuals, faith that individuals are intrinsically good people, that they are born good people, and the conditioning that happens around them is what kind of leads to this world and this demagogic state that we've all lost faith in. And I'm going to tell you just a short story about what happened after the Pulse nightclub attack last year. There was 49 people in Orlando were shot by a purported Muslim in a gay club. And I thought, whoa, well, that's the first time my two identities and area have clashed together. I do say I live in quite a small Venn diagram. I know it's a scientific concept, but I live in a small one. And I thought, well, all I'm reading in the headlines is that when you bring these two together and you come and hang out in my little Venn diagram, it just seems to be bloodshed, and I'm not cool with that. So I organised something called the Big Gay Iftar. Now, for people who don't know, iftar is the fast opening meal during Ramadan, and it was Ramadan at the time. And I thought, well, I'm going to do that, and I just need a place for people to get to. So I called my friend who is a priest, and he said, well, why don't you have my church? I was like, oh, well, that's pretty cool. How much does it cost? He's like, it's free. I was like, oh, yeah, God, cool. Like, and we got a church, and then we filled it full of people. And there was a moment as we were organising it, in 4 days, we were organising it, and a woman called Asma, she said, I will cook. She has a beautiful restaurant. She said, I will cook your meal. I will do it for free because that is what Ramadan is about. It's about feeding people. And I was like, well, hang on. Do you know like the audience here and it's LGBT people? She's like, you need to eat. Of course I'm going to feed you. And she said, well, I don't have enough money. And I said, well, I don't know how to get the money in time. And then out of nowhere, probably faith, someone said, well, I'll give you some money to do it. And that somewhere was Pride in London. So all of a sudden, I was really clashing these two areas. And I thought, well, that's amazing. At Big Gay Iftar, people will come together, sit on the floor, and now it's become a tradition. And that's all because individuals, intrinsically, are good people. And how can we lose faith in that? The second is in love. How can we lose faith in love, in that anxiety, in that kind of evidence-driven, but not too evidence-driven, of how you fall in love? I think no two people coming together is the same. But, you know, the one thing that people do have when they start to court, which is, I imagine, what people do, is wait for that blue double tick, that anxiety of, like, oh, is they going to reply? And how can we lose faith in that? That's beautiful. Like, we can't lose faith. Like, imagine if that was evidence-based. Like, you say this, you get the blue double tick. I don't want to live in that world because it will be quite formulaic. And that's AI. It's going to take all your jobs and all your love lives. And I think, you know, that's... I can't believe no one has quoted George Michael yet. But, you know, we've got to wait for something more. There's that feeling, right, that you've got to have faith. And there was a question earlier, Ken, about, well, you know, who believes that the world was made in 7 days? Craig David, the rapper. He believed that his life was made in 7 days. Yeah, well, you know, but I don't believe in those kind of ego-driven individuals, and Craig David is one. The faith, and so the third area is kind of the faith in the journey of life. I think we've all got that. 12 years ago was the last time I was in Cambridge, and it was around this time of year I was here for my interview at Downing College. Now, if you're wondering how that went, I should have stood up and went, Asad Dunner, University of Warwick. But over those 12 years, a lot has happened, and I've had faith in what's happened to me. You know, I was massively in the closet at the time. I really wondered about how these, you know, what would happen? Should I believe? What do I do? And, you know, I came out, and then I had a couple of options. One of them was apparently I should die. Missed that one. But I could have done something like join the ex-Muslim council. But I joined Iman, and Iman is an LGBTQ Muslim charity, and has a similar number of people, possibly more, but I'm not one for that. And that's full of people who are struggling with their sexuality and questioning their faith, like me. And I feel like every time I question it, I just get better. Because I'm like, I know the hole, and I know the flaw, and I know it's there. And I'm allowed to say it's there, and other people are allowed to point that out to me as well. And there's something about that. There's something about being a minority in a minority, right? And the term minority blows my mind, because I think language is really important, and I think the word ex-Muslim is a really loaded term, and I'm really glad Russell Brand isn't here today, because I don't think Katy Perry goes around saying, I am the ex-Russell Brand, I am the ex of Russell Brand. She goes around going, I sang Firework, I'm really cool. She's changed the nomenclature around who she is. So I just think that's quite interesting in how you define yourself about not being in the faith, but I think that's one for separate. I think the other thing, and the fourth thing, is that faith in ourselves, that faith in overcoming obstacles, that faith in saying, do you know what? I'm going to be all right. And I think in a group like this of such young, talented people who will be future leaders of the world, to lose that really, really scares me. And I think what made me so sad was the point from the floor over here, which was that, you know, we've lost faith in human nature. That makes me so sad, because if we lose faith in human nature, let's let the robots in and have their way forward, and we should just do something else. And that's what humans are about. So, have we lost faith in faith? Yes, if we define faith as institutions, and institutions led by demagogic figures who grow into power and have egos. But really, we've got to have faith. I think the vote here for the opposition is that vote the faith of the individual, that people are intrinsically good, that faith in the blue double tick, that, you know, is it going to happen? The faith in the journey of life, and the faith that someday, as humans who have human nature, we will intrinsically all be a force for good.
Thank you very much to Asad and to all our speakers tonight. As ever at the Union, the one thing left to do is to vote, and voting is by our feet. The motion before the House this evening is this House has lost faith in faith. If you would like to vote in favour of the motion in proposition, please walk out of the right-hand door marked ayes. If in opposition of the motion, out of the left-hand door marked noes, and if in abstention, through the centre door. Thank you very much for being here tonight.